before the court. The primary one is the question of jurisdiction in this case. Mr. Jackson, prior to trial, had made a motion to have this case dismissed for lack of subject matter jurisdiction because the land on which the offense occurred had been taken from the reservation, was no longer reservation property, and we're asking this court to overturn the lower court's decision, finding that, in fact, that land remained part of the reservation. This is a case of congressional intent, congressional language. The lower court did an extensive report and recommendation regarding the law in this case, and obviously made some distinctions that we don't agree with regarding the language. The operative language that we're dealing with.
So let me ask you a question. If you're right, and he's and this is, you know, the federal courts lack jurisdiction. The Minnesota courts have already said they lack jurisdiction. So is this just the place where everybody's going to go to commit crimes because nobody's got jurisdiction over it?
No, I would believe that if this court were to rule that there was no jurisdiction, the Minnesota courts would then revisit that original decision.
Why do you think that?
Well, because the
binding on them.
Well, but as the Minnesota court stated in Luciera, they were going to defer to prior federal decisions, and in this court's
Supreme Court, the U.S.
Yes,
Supreme Court.
Yes,
well,
yeah.
We're not the Supreme Court.
No, I understand that, but I don't think
pretty good analysis, pretty careful analysis of Supreme Court precedent.
It is. It is. Luciera is actually. I mean,
you really want us to overrule Luciera?
Yes, yes. I don't think there's any choice. I think the court would have to. I think the court's decision.
Well,
we can't.
Yes. And that really, as a practical matter, would have to happen. And then nobody's going to allow the cases to slip through the cracks. But I think, it is.
I think that is not self-evident.
Perhaps. But I don't think anybody was going to forget about
the crack might exist for 10 years from.
It's possible. But in any event, I mean, I think the court has to look at the language of the act that is involved here, which stated that the land involved had been, as the act stated, it said, the railroad company shall have the right to select and take from the lands of the Red Lake Indian Reservation this particular property. And the language, select and take, is pretty clear, and it certainly implies an intent to have that land taken from the reservation and to diminish. I mean, the operative language that many courts use is this diminish language, although it's clear that there is no controlling language that needs to be stated. And so the distinction that's made by the lower court regarding the prior act of 1904, in which they used the language hereby cede, surrender, grant and convey to the United States all their claim, right, and title and interest. Certainly that's different language, but it's really no different in definition.
What would you have us make of the footnote in Solem?
The footnote regarding the, which footnote?
That the use of the word diminish in these ancient statutes is suspect, basically disregarded.
Correct.
Congress then didn't understand or didn't make the distinction that's critical now.
Yes, I mean, I think you have to accept that, and I think you have to accept the Supreme Court's.
Well, then the district court got it right.
Well, I'm arguing that the district court got it wrong because.
I mean, but how would we not? We just tell the Supreme Court we're ignoring that footnote?
Well, but there is no language. Well, there is part. There's the language diminished in the Section 3 of the Act, but the first section only deals with that right to select and take. There's no mention of diminishment of the reservation. And then when we deal with the alcohol clause, which really makes, I mean, there's no purpose of having the alcohol clause unless Congress's intent was to take that property from the reservation. For why else would they have to reserve the right to enforce the alcohol prohibition on that particular land? There's no reason. There's no reason for that language. And I think that's the argument.
The Supreme Court says Congress wasn't thinking in these terms. Besides, well, Congress does redundant things all the time.
Yes, they do, but I mean, I think you have to look at the language and make it
without the word, without the reference to the diminished reservation.
Yes.
In what is it, Section 5? You haven't got a leg here.
Well, I think we do.
That's not okay.
Well, I mean, if you can
make the argument, but these arguments have been rejected right and left.
Well, they haven't
until you get the Yankton Soup issue.
Yes,
and that unique. Reservation.
But the language, I mean, it hasn't been rejected regarding this particular land on this particular reservation.
Well,
La Sierra's
at great length explaining how unique.
But that's a state court case.
What?
That's a state court case. I mean, that was the Minnesota Supreme Court. So,
it's not controlling, but if it's persuasive, then we follow it. And their lengthy dissertation of how this reservation is unique in the way it evolved. It was never land granted back to the Indians.
Correct.
And that's the sort of analysis, I guess, that applied to Yankton Sioux, but it seems to me it leads in the opposite direction here.
Well, I think as the lower court said, that it was persuasive, and we're stuck with that. But again, I think we go back to our original argument that...
What's this 300 acres used for now?
Well, I mean, there was...
Is there a village on the 300 acres?
The village of Redby.
Okay, does the state of Minnesota collect Minnesota taxes on that?
From some of the property owners. There are non-Indian property owners who pay taxes to the state of Minnesota, and that was...
Did have bought allotments that were on there? Was this allotment...
I'm not certain about. I don't know if it was allotted originally, but there are non-Indian owners of that property, and I think the court conceded that. I mean, it was raised in the lower court, and the magistrate really didn't make any particular findings regarding whether taxes were paid, and didn't give it any particular importance. But I think it was raised because it is important. It certainly shows the intent of how that land is being used today. It's being treated. If they're obtaining state-paid taxes off it, they're certainly using it for state purposes. And the fact that this, I mean, hasn't been raised really since the Lucier decision doesn't necessarily mean that this court simply can't stand in and make its own determination of what the congressional intent was. I also wanted to talk about the sentencing issue briefly. Mr. Jackson was given a short departure from the guideline range on the second count, which was consecutive to the mandatory minimum on the first count. And I think it's important that Mr. Jackson was burned, in my opinion, was burned by the government, and to the extent that he cooperated many times, sat down for multiple interviews. These were disclosed in the government's position paper prior to sentencing, and it was further told to the court at the time of sentencing. He was then a witness in a case that resolved shortly before sentencing, in which the government then made the determination he wasn't going to be given a 5K motion, and the court wouldn't give him any credit for that. And I think a person in Mr. Jackson's status who lives on the reservation, who's a young man, whose family is on the reservation. He had numerous sisters and his mother who continue to live up there.
How fast do you think the Supreme Court would reverse this if we wrote an opinion reversing this sentence on the grounds that the district court abused its discretion because the guidelines, in the words of your brief, should have no part of the analysis in this situation?
Probably very quickly.
Yeah,
right. Right.
I mean, that'd be pretty summary, wouldn't it?
I understand that precedent's against me, right? But I don't want
to. I've got a new job description.
I'm not going to not make the point because I believe it. I think Mr. Jackson should have been given more.
Well, it's a perfectly good argument to the sentencing judge.
Yes. Yes.
The Supreme Court says, but not to us.
Well, I'm asking this court to stand up and accept my position. Okay. Thank you. If the court has no other questions, I'll rest.
Mr. Wardlaw.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Clifford Wardlaw. I appear on behalf of the United States in this case. This case does not involve surplus unallotted lands. When you take a look at the Supreme Court cases that address the issue of diminishment or disestablishment, you're talking about the federal government, Congress, making a decision to open up surplus unallotted land for settlement by non-Indians. This case, the Act of 1905, granted a railway a right-of-way, a limited amount of land, 320 acres, for a terminal and a rail line. That's
you're,
all.
Are you now you're talking about the Allotment Act basis for it isn't involved here. Is that what you're talking about?
Exactly, Your Honor.
Congress outside of that can, by act of Congress, diminish a reservation completely separate from the Allotment Act, can it?
Historically, Congress has. The Rosebud cases are example where in three acts, Congress took four counties off the Rosebud Reservation. But when you're looking at other cases like the Yankton Sioux line of cases, which this panel has heard the Yankton Sioux cases over and over and over again up to 2010, over 20 years this line of cases has gone on, those cases involve the implementation of surplus land acts. And Yankton Sioux is a great example of that because what Congress is doing is implementing the Dawes Act. And the Dawes Act allowed a process by which the Department of the Interior would send out a representative. There would be negotiations that would go on between the tribe and the government. An agreement would be reached. That agreement then would be sent to Congress, and then Congress enacted in 1984 that agreement that had been reached before. But Congress can act unilaterally, but many of these cases do involve a consultative process with the tribe where an agreement is reached prior to these lands being opened up. But the point being that what this 1905 Act is implementing is a railway right-of-way procedure. It is not opening up surplus unallotted lands for settlement by non-Indians.
Well, the right-of-way, there was a conveyance for a right-of-way up to this 320 acres, wasn't there?
Yes.
And so the this crime didn't occur on the right-of-way, did it? It was up in the village, wasn't it?
Well, what happened, and there was no agreement between the defense and the government about where the crime occurred. There was an alleyway that the defendant drove. On the right-hand side of the alleyway is plot 29, where the defendant said the shooting occurred. And on the left side is the post office where the victim was found. So, but the court, district court, said, I'm going to assume that it occurred in plot 29.
Does it make a difference, I mean, under the Act?
No.
So it's all covered by the same statute?
It's all covered by the definition of Indian country that's found in 1151. Because 1151 says that it's all land within the limits of any Indian reservation under the jurisdiction of the United States. Red Lake certainly is. By statute, 1162 says Red Lake is federal jurisdiction. Notwithstanding an issuance of any patent, so the ownership issue is not critical here. And when you boil down the appellant's argument, he's basically saying this is private land because it's private land, it's not Indian country. While 1151 says that doesn't matter.
Well, you said answered Judge Perry that it didn't make any difference, but when you kind of throw railroad law in too, this could have been simply an easement, or it could have been fee title to the railroad, which would make a difference on the ingress and egress to this 320 acres. So you have to analyze the language of what happened here with both of those things in mind.
Right.
And I just wanted to be sure that it didn't happen where on this allotment for ingress and egress to the 320 acres, and you've answered that question.
The defense said that it did, and the court assumed that it did. Now, the final part of 1151A talks about Indian country includes rights of way running through the reservation. So it's within the boundaries, and the only thing this statute did was to grant the railway up to 320 acres. The Red Lake Indian.
This was 6 years after the right-of-way statute, by its own terms.
Yes, and when you take
this was not granting a right-of-way.
No, the statute says that the railroad is authorized to take from the land up to 320 acres for rail and terminal. And that is clear by the congressional history, which is very limited in this case. But a congressman speaking about this act talked about railway right-of-ways, giving railways the right to access right-of-way in Indian country.
Okay, so this says that the right-of-way we approved in 1899 is now to be not land selected by the railroad not to exceed 320 acres, and then it says makes a reference to the diminished reservation.
Correct.
Shall be held to be and to remain a part of the diminished Red Lake Reservation. And without the footnote in Solemn, you would have difficulty. We would have difficulty, wouldn't we, distinguishing Yankton Sioux?
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor.
The whole intent, I mean, everything stays, land, surplus land sold to non-Indians continues to be Indian country unless that by that act or otherwise the reservation's diminished. So Yankton Sioux is now a checkerboard.
Exactly, and that's the result that would happen if you accepted the defense argument, where we would have up to 300.
We'd have one checkerboard square in the Red Lake.
And that
or
is
maybe there are more. I don't know, but if Congress said we're diminishing the reservation by 320 acres, and if the Supreme Court would agree that Congress meant what it said. Words applied this plain language in 1905 instead of saying Congress really didn't understand what they were talking about, which is what Solem says, then the defendant would be right, and Minnesota would have to reconsider whether it wants to take jurisdiction.
But the Yankton Sioux language that was found in the 1894 Act is talking about cede, sell, relinquish, convey to the United States all their claim, right, title, and interest to all the unallotted lands within the limits of the reservation.
Well, that's not too different than here, where they say we give up everything except the no liquor federal law.
But Red Lake was never subject to the allotment process that was found in the Yankton Sioux cases.
But that's Judge Beam's point. That's not dispositive. The question, the governing question, as I understand the Supreme Court's jurisprudence, is whether Congress intended to diminish the res.
Exactly. When you're taking a look at the language.
And they said it. The plain language.
No.
Says, by reason of this statute, the reservation is diminished.
And diminishment in that term, the state Supreme Court in Lucier also talked about diminishment there. It says diminishment more in a sense of the amount of land that the tribe owns is reduced, but the reservation boundaries are not diminished.
Under tribal control.
Yes.
Is the railroad operating?
No, sir.
Okay. Has the railroad been abandoned?
Yes.
Did the railroad dispose of the right-of-way property?
Yes. The small amount of land on Red Lake, of there are only 284 acres on the reservation that are not owned by the tribe. The rest of the
Did it convey whatever right, title, and interest it had back to the tribe?
No. Some of the land did, but some of the land within the village of Redby was sold to private parties.
By the railroad?
Yes.
Well, that's sort of leads against your point, doesn't it? There was a total diminishment of the reservation in the interest of the railroad, because usually when you abandon a right-of-way, the property reverts to the landowners on each side, which was Indian property here, wasn't it?
Yes, but the definition of Indian country found in 1151A includes privately owned land.
Well, I understand that.
So the government's argument is that there's no clear congressional language diminishing the reservation. There's no language of some certain. The Yankton Sioux cases have a particular specific mention of some certain, and there's a lack of legislative history. If there are no more questions, I'll sit down now. Thank you.
He has 12 seconds remaining.
I'll wait back.
Well, it's an interesting issue, and it's been well briefed and argued. And it's been under advisement.